This is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation, October 17th, 2008. I'm Curtis Fox. This week, poetry for an economic downturn. At the beginning of the financial crisis, President Bush said of the economy, "This sucker could go down." The financial system nearly did go down, and still could, just as it did in 1929. So it's no surprise that people have been using the D word recently. The Depression is on our minds, if only because we might be about to enter one. The Depression scarred a generation and left its mark on poets. Philip Levine was born in 1928 in Detroit, which suffered massive unemployment in the 1930s. Life in a down-and-out industrial city comes up a lot in the work of Philip Levine, who has won a Pulitzer and is now a distinguished poet in residence at New York University. We're going to hear him read two of his poems, and I've asked Edward Hirsch to listen in with us. We're in Edward Hirsch's Midtown Manhattan office, where he is the president of the Guggenheim Foundation. More to our purposes, he is a poet. He has also written a lot about poetry, including the 1999 bestseller How to Read a Poem and Fall in Love with Poetry. Hi, Ed.
Hi, Curtis.
So you're much younger than Philip Levine. You're a totally different generation. Do you remember when you first read him?
Yes, I do. I mean, he's part of a generation that really brought me into poetry, that when I was first coming up as a teenager in my 19, 20, 21 years old, I discovered the generation of Philip Levine, Galway Kinnell, Adrian Rich, W.S. Merwin, James Merrill, Richard Howard. I mean, to me, that was poetry, what they were doing, what James Wright was doing, what Robert Bly was doing. I guess I've been reading Levine my whole writing life.
Now, I was reading or rereading his selected poems, and I was struck by how unironic the work of Philip Levine is.
Well, I don't agree with that, actually. I think there are ironies in his work, but I think they're not cynical poems. Mm. I think what you might be calling irony is a kind of, there's no detachment. Mm. But what I respond to is the utter conviction of the work, the commitment of the work, the values of the work, and the way the poems are really driven home with a kind of terrific verbal force. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's really an inheritor of Whitman. He really saw the people around him, and he really wanted to bring them into poetry. That's what I think of as Whitman-esque, that you bring ordinary people into poetry and you evoke the world of what working people are like.
So we're going to go into a poem that does go into working class concerns or working concerns. Here's Philip Levine reading What Work Is.
We stand in the rain in a long line waiting at Ford Highland Park for work. You know what work is. If you're old enough to read this, you know what work is, although you may not do it. Forget you. This is about waiting. Shifting from one foot to another, feeling the light rain falling like mist into your hair, blurring your vision, until you think you see your own brother ahead of you, maybe 10 places. You rub your glasses with your fingers, and of course it's someone else's brother, narrower across the shoulders than yours, but with the same sad slouch, the grin that does not hide the stubbornness, the sad refusal to give in to rain, to the hours wasted waiting, to the knowledge that somewhere ahead, a man is waiting who will say, "No, we're not hiring today, for any reason he wants." You love your brother. Now suddenly you can hardly stand the love flooding you for your brother, who's not beside you or behind or ahead, because he's home, trying to sleep off a miserable night shift at Cadillac so he can get up before noon to study his German. Works 8 hours a night so he can sing Wagner, the opera you hate most, the worst music ever invented. How long has it been since you told him you loved him? Held his wide shoulders, opened your eyes wide, and said those words, and maybe kissed his cheek. You've never done something so simple, so obvious. Not because you're too young or too dumb. Not because you're jealous or even mean or incapable of crying in the presence of another man. No. Just because you don't know what work is.
You know, when we recorded him, I asked him if he wouldn't mind reading the poems twice in case he made a mistake or he wanted to edit it later, and he said, "Fuck no."
Sounds like Phil.
Anyhow, so but he's a wonderful reader. He actually doesn't need to read it twice. What's the implication at the very end? Just because he doesn't know what work is, does that account for his emotional distance from his brother, that he's not as affectionate? I don't quite get that very ending.
I have to say it's a peculiar ending. I can't say I completely understand it myself. You think you get it.
Yeah.
But it is very odd, which is the logic of it is you've never kissed your brother. You've never really embraced him in the deepest possible way. Why? You've never done anything so simple, so obvious. Why not? Not because you're too young or too dumb, although the suggestion is you are too young and too dumb.
Right.
Not because you're jealous or even mean. You're all of those things.
Or incapable of crying in the presence of another man. No. Just because you don't know what work is.
And all I can take that to mean is you haven't actually experienced it deeply and fully enough that even though it says early on you know what work is, you haven't actually suffered it.
That's
so
what it
much.
Is. Yeah, you haven't suffered enough.
You haven't suffered it enough to really understand what it does to people.
Right, right.
So, I mean, in a way, it's you don't know what work does as well as what work is.
Yeah, and by work, he's not meaning office work. He's talking about
This is hard manual labor. I don't know if anyone who's ever done, you know, worked in factories as I did when I was a kid.
Did you?
Knows you don't want to do it anymore.
Right.
I mean, it's really brutalizing.
Yeah. And here he is. Not he doesn't even have the job. He's waiting in line, and he's going to be lucky if he gets that miserable job.
Well, there's a duo there, his brother who has a job,
right,
who's now sleeping it off, and he who's waiting to get a job, hoping to get a job, because the worst, you know, even worse than having a job is not having one.
Right. And we see this today all over with day laborers, a lot of Latin Americans sitting on corners waiting around all day for somebody to come by and give them a crappy job that pays $6 an hour.
I mean, I think part of this poem is that there's going to be a foreman and there's going to be a guy who can turn you down just
right.
because he wants to, who really has power over you.
Yeah.
And there's something really brutal about the rawness of it.
Yeah. He would be a good poet for the candidates, the presidential candidates, to read right about now, wouldn't you think?
I think that would be very helpful, especially for one who seems to have gotten really far from what working people are really like.
I mean, he will remain nameless in this podcast. So let's go to another poem. But it's called They Feed, They Lion, and it's a much older poem from a 1972 book. First, let's hear how Levine introduces it.
This poem grew out of my return to Detroit, the city where I grew up, after the riots of 1967, called race riots in the press, called the Great Rebellion in the city itself. And as I went back to the city, I discovered in the language of that day that I was part of the problem, not part of the solution. I was now middle-aged, I was middle class, and I was white. And I was, to some degree, just overwhelmed.
Is there anything that that would help us grasp it a little bit as we hear it?
This is a really great American poem, I think. I guess the thing to pay attention to is it's not quite as literal in the same way as what work is, which is in a plainer diction. This is in a richer, more Dylan Thomas-esque kind of language. And I guess that you should pay attention to the way that black vernacular is used in the poem. So that when you hear the word, they feed, they lion, it means something like they feed the lion and they feed their lion, which is the way they would be used in black vernacular. And, of course, he makes a lot out of it poetically.
So here's Philip Levine reading They Feed, They Lion.
Out of burlap sacks, out of bearing butter, out of black bean and wet slate bread, out of the acids of rage, the candor of tar, out of creosote, gasoline, drive shafts, wooden dollies, they lie and grow. Out of the gray hills of industrial barns, out of rain, out of bus ride West Virginia to kiss my ass, out of buried aunties, mothers hardening like pounded stumps, out of stumps, out of the bones need to sharpen, and the muscles to stretch. They lie and grow. Earth is eating trees, fence posts, gutted cars. Earth is calling in her little ones. Come home, from pig balls. From the ferocity of pig driven to holiness, from the furred ear and the full jowl, come the repose of the hung belly, from the purpose they lie and grow. From the sweet glues of the trotters, come the sweet kinks of the fist, from the full flower of the hams, the thorax of caves, from bow down come rise up, come they lie in from the reeds of shovels, the grained arm that pulls the hands, they lie and grow. From my five arms and all my hands, from all my white sins forgiven, they feed. From my car passing under the stars, they lie in. From my children inherit, from the oak turned to a wall, they lie in. From they sack and they belly opened, and all that was hidden burning, on the oil-stained earth, they feed, they lion, and he comes.
What a poem.
Yeah.
What a poem. It's just, it's thrilling every time I hear it. It's just a spectacular performance.
There's some language in there that's a lot more complicated and not to be taken literally, particularly
from pig balls. From the ferocity of pig driven to holiness. From the furred ear and the full jowl. Come the repose of the hung belly.
What do you make of that?
I think he's evoking here the way that the pig is central in African-American culture. And I think he's picking up on that, and especially from the South. I mean, this whole first part of the poem is about the great migration from people coming from the South up to the industrial Midwestern cities like Chicago and Detroit. And so this is, I mean, there's actually a journey here.
Out of the gray hills of industrial barns, out of rain, out of bus ride, West Virginia to kiss my ass.
I mean, they're just coming forward, and there's a kind of relentless rhythm here, Whitman-esque rhythm, that gives the sense of this migration and this force that can't be stopped. And I think the pig, the pig balls and the ferocity of pig driven to holiness, to something sacred, is evoking that whole, in an angular way, the whole culture of blacks migrating north.
Mm-hmm. Now, the rhythm of this is so different than the first poem we heard.
They feed, they lie and grow.
The music is driving the poem in They Feed, They Lie in a way that's different than, say, What Work Is, where you'd say the music is very subtle and operating on behalf of the story. Here, the music is driving the feeling, and the feeling gives this sense of something, actually, some kind of almost second coming. They feed, they lie in, and he comes.
Something's going to happen.
Something's going to happen. Yeah. Something is bursting. It's 1967.
Yeah.
Something's being held down. A lid's been held on the society and the cities that can't be held down, and it's actually breaking loose.
And it got worse the next year with the assassination of Martin Luther King.
It's important to invoke that moment and what happens when certain forces are unleashed and then the counterforces. I mean, I think you want a just society. You need a just society, because if you don't have a just society, then you have these really extraordinary rebellions. People just can't bear the way they're living anymore, and they respond.
Edward Hirsch, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Edward Hirsch's latest book of poems is Special Orders, published by Knopf. You can hear him talk about the complex relationship between American poets and painters in a new Poetry Foundation podcast called Poetry Lectures. Check it out on poetryfoundation.org or subscribe in the iTunes store. Philip Levine's latest book of poems is called Breath, and it's also published by Knopf. Let us know what you think of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. The music used in this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. For Poetry Off the Shelf, I'm Curtis Fox. Thanks for listening.